Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
There were children, and then there were the children of Indians. Because the merciless, savage inhabitants of these American lands did not make children but nits, and nits make lice. Or so it was said by the man who meant to make a massacre feel like killing bugs at Sand Creek, when 700 drunken men came at dawn with cannons, and then again 4 years later, almost to the day, the same way at Washita River, where afterward, 700 Indian horses were rounded up and shot in the head.
That's Tommy Orange, reading the opening paragraph of his latest novel, Wandering Stars. Tommy is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. You may have read his best-selling debut novel, There, There. It was the winner of the Penn Hemingway Award, the John Leonard Prize, and the American Book Award. It was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. If you haven't read There, There, there is no time like the present. Well, maybe wait until this interview is over. That's because Tommy has now followed up his stellar debut with Wandering Stars. It is both a prequel and a sequel to There, There, and it's just as powerful. Wandering Stars chronicles over 150 years of three indigenous families, and it becomes a scathing indictment of America's war on its own people. Tommy joins us now to talk about the book and why this time it was more difficult for him to write.
Among other things, I think, you know, writing There, There, I didn't really have any concept of an audience or a reader base. So that was a whole new group of voices to allow into my head and the, you know, in the writing space. I think the sophomore effort just has a lot of pressure around it because you have to like at least do something as good. And when you have something that's really successful, that kind of pressure can be really challenging when it comes to the writing space and trying to like have a clear head and become writing from a place that's more pure. And, you know, what brought you to writing in the first place is really where you want to be coming from. And then, you know, 2 years of it were during a pandemic, and writing already without any of that is hard. And I'd never wanted to write historical fiction. And, you know, the first third of this book is definitely historical fiction. But this piece of information about this prison castle being the sort of origin story of the Carlisle Indian School and boarding schools in general, and that Southern Cheyennes were really kind of at the center of that, it just drew me in as soon as I found out.
Yeah, it's a very gripping opening. And it's gripping and very immersive throughout. You told a Chicago audience that so many of the characters in There, There were actually parts of yourself. Is that also the case with Wandering Stars?
Maybe a little less so, especially the historical piece. But then again, you know, when I think about somebody like Charles, he's the son of Jude Starr, that's the first person that you meet in the novel. I would say I share a lot in common on an interior level with Charles. So yes and no. And I think I feel more distant from maybe some of the characters like Luther in the contemporary part of the novel. That's where I draw from when I'm trying to write interiority. It comes from my own. It's sort of unavoidable, I think, that the characters will end up sharing things with me.
Mm-hmm. If you don't mind my asking, how do you go about developing your characters?
You know, part of it is mysterious. Like, some lines just come out and they feel distinct and directly related to the character that you're intending to write about. And then some of it's revision, just really at the sentence level. I really, I try to make the sentences sound good and also related to the character specifically, so that when you're reading the lines, you're really getting a feel for who the character is, what they think about, how they feel. So I kind of write from the inside out. I really think about their insides first before I put them in a scene, before I have them doing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really noticed that. That's, I think, one of the strengths of your writing. You wrote an epigraph for Wandering Stars. Could you share the sentence you wrote?
Sure. For everyone surviving and not surviving this thing called and not called addiction.
If you don't mind my asking, have you had struggles with addiction?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I wouldn't be able to write a book like this had I not had experience. But, and it's not just me, you know, my whole family. My life has sort of been shaped and mangled by addiction. So I feel like writing about it to the extent that I did in this book, and I already had it in there, was a way to process a lot too.
Wandering Stars opens with the exploration of three generations of a family, and they are all impacted by the real-life Sand Creek Massacre of 1864. Can you tell us about this horrible event?
Yeah, so I grew up hearing my dad tell this story, and he grew up hearing his great-grandparents tell it, various different people who were much closer to the event. It was deeply shattering to the lives of my tribe. I didn't quite know why he was telling me that, why we heard the story more than once, aside from this sort of sentiment of like, don't forget what happened. But actually, it was his naming story. It's where he got his name. He was named after a boy was saved a baby from the massacre and was given the name Whitebird. And that's my dad's Cheyenne name. So it was a naming story, and I sort of didn't realize that until much later. So it was just something that I grew up knowing about, and this was sort of rubbed up against the way they teach it in school, which is mostly just the pilgrims, the meal, and then skip forward to, you don't even skip forward. You just never hear about Native people again. You just hear the sort of origin story thing. Because a lot of Native history, if you're telling it, it doesn't do the sort of nationalistic, patriotic work that they try to do to you in institutionalized schooling. I don't mean to sound so extreme, but it really, you know, memorizing wars and dates and people's birth dates is sort of a ridiculous way to think about thinking and education. So it was, you know, it was just this thing that I knew was devastating to our people, and finding out about this prison castle thing, I wanted to go back and start at that point because it was the beginning of a split, even of our own tribe. A bunch of us ended up in Montana and then Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. You're an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. I wonder, what kind of psychic toll does it take on you when you write about all of the horrible slaughter and violence that America has inflicted on its own people?
Writing about it doesn't feel like a weight. It feels like trying to work something out. It feels like exercising something, or it feels like processing, rather than trudging out demons or anything that would feel like it would add to a burden. It's not, you know, the part that's challenging about writing is just that writing is really hard, and to get it right, you really have to look at your sentences a lot. And if you're a naturally self-loathing person as I am, that's, you know, a lot of personal work that you have to just get over to get through the revision process. But the actual content, what I'm writing about, it never feels like it's taking a toll. If anything, it feels like I'm working with the material that if I don't, is going to do something worse inside.
Yeah. A young boy named Jude Starr survives the Sand Creek Massacre, but he is sent to a prison castle in Florida with his friend Victor Bearshield. They both start families in Oklahoma, but their children are sent to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School. What happens there?
So this was, you know, Richard Henry Pratt got the idea for the boarding schools from this experience of having 3 years of mostly men. There was one woman. There was about 71 prisoners. They were prisoners of war. They were mostly adults. I think there was a few teenagers in there. So he saw that they could be civilized using military training and teaching them Christianity and English, and decided, well, let's do that to all of the Native children in the country. And kill the Indian, save the man was the motto or the slogan that drove this policy. And sometimes kids were taken hostage for some of the tribes that weren't behaving or, you know, were more like causing problems. This was to get them to behave better. They'd end up going to those places and getting those children to be in the school. And the school, basically, they would punish the children for speaking their language. They weren't able to carry on a lot of the traditional practices and the culture, and they were taught Christianity and English, and basically the Way of Washington was one of the ways, what they called it. The idea was that that being Native was not a value, it was actually something that needed to be destroyed. And that went on for decades, not just Carlisle, there were boarding schools all around the country. I mean, into the 60s and 70s, where there was still abuse happening and still this same ideology about, you know, Native people are less than, they're subhuman, and in order to rise above that, they need to be Christian and never value their who they really are.
Yeah, I was shocked when I read that motto, kill the Indian, save the man, in your book. Yeah, just terrible, yeah. And we learn that Charles and Opal are ancestors of the family, and they're there. And this is that kind of blew my mind. It's such a fantastic revelation. Did you plan that to happen from the beginning when you first started writing Wandering Stars, or did it just kind of occur to you while you were writing?
It was kind of a crazy thing. So when I first started writing Wandering Stars, there was no historical piece. I was picking it up right after the powwow. And I was in Sweden for a translation of There, There in 2019. And I was invited to go to a museum, and there was Southern Cheyenne stuff there behind glass. And the curator person was taking me around and sort of like apologetic, like, sorry, we have your stuff. We're trying to figure out what to do with it. But I saw a newspaper clipping there, and it said Southern Cheyennes in St. Augustine, Florida, 1875. I think it was one of these before and after shots of like when they came to the prison castle, they were wearing, you know, regalia or hides or, you know, whatever they were wearing, leggings. And then they were made to wear military uniforms, sort of showing that they can be like us, they can be humans if we just teach them. And so I just fell into a rabbit hole. This just fascinated me that this was the beginning of the boarding schools. But I was doing research. It was a book called War Dance at Fort Marion. It was somewhere in the book while I was reading, it has a list of all the prisoners. And one of the prisoners' names was Star, and I was already writing a character with the last name Star. A few names down, I saw the name Bearshield, and I just was blown away. It's, you know, I couldn't have planned that, but I started thinking of it as a generational novel. At first, I was trying to do something more nonlinear, where you jump back and forth in time, but I realized, actually, after reading Oscar Hokea's book, Calling for a Blanket Dance, there's something he does that sort of builds upon generations and through time. I started wanting to have something do that, and because there was a Bearshield actually at the prison castle, I thought, well, what if this was a family line? And we ended up at the aftermath, and we sort of, because we start off with a young man running away from a shooting, it parallels Orville's same trajectory or same experience.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very well done, very well executed by you. You've mentioned prison castles a few times, and I wanted to get more of a handle on what they are, because once I read the revelation, you know, the reveal in your book, I started thinking, well, are prison castles the same as Alcatraz? I thought it was maybe, you know, because Alcatraz shows up in there. What is a prison castle?
I don't know how many there are. This was just a fort that was turned into a prison. But the name of it initially had castle in the name. And you know, it actually is a star fort. It's actually, if you look from above, it's shaped like a star. This was another coincidence where I was like, you know, I thought of the title before anything. These stars kept showing up, and I just felt like I'm onto something here. So this was first built to protect like the Atlantic trade route. It was the Spaniards built it, and it was changed into a prison. This one just was particularly fascinating to me because it was shaped like a star, and because of what happened there. There's other Native history too. Geronimo was there with a whole bunch of other prisoners in the late 1800s.
Right, interesting. What was the biggest challenge you faced while writing Wandering Stars?
I think it's the same thing for any long-term project. It's the how to sustain the belief in it, to keep going back to it. That requires some amount of sustained belief in yourself that you have the ability to get the thing all the way done. And that, you know, there's a lot of time you spend in the middle of writing a novel where you're not sure how it's going to come together or how it's going to be whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you want readers to take away from Wandering Stars?
I think with the open-ended ending with "they're there" and the sort of lack of resolve, even though Wandering Stars doesn't have some kind of like happy ending, I did want it to resolve. So, you know, anybody who read "They're There" and reads Wandering Stars, I want it to feel like the journey that was complete. A lot of the times, people don't understand the nuance of Native life and contemporary life. And a lot of times we are authenticated from the outside. And the fact that we don't always look the way that people think we should look, because the only thing that's taught is the sort of pilgrim Indians. And a lot of times not having a certain kind of connection to our culture, the burden is put on us. So people don't understand the campaign against the erasure of Native people and how long it's been going on. So I think giving context and giving this history to allow more understanding for who we are, I think that is something that I would like readers to experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tommy Orange, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Wandering Stars. It's an incredible achievement.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Tommy Orange is the author of Wandering Stars, the sequel to his best-selling They're There. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Moshe Kasher, Sloan Crosley, and Tommy Orange.
What you're gleaning from these interviews is groundbreaking.
Don't forget to subscribe to Beta on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Be sure to offer a rating. That'll help us build our Alpha Army. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta.
Oh, it's going to be on the internet, too. It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You're devoid of anything that's remotely caring or empathetic.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Because he's a cool guy, and now he's turning into one of those guys.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I don't let you talk much because I'm always afraid to hear what you're going to say to me.